Imagine you've saved up for this incredibly high-end stereo system. You know, you get the expensive receiver, the premium speakers, and you plug it all in, hit play.
And you're expecting this crisp, perfect music,
Right,
right?
exactly. But instead, you just hear this low, constant, irritating static.
Oh, man. And naturally, your first instinct is to blame the new gear. I mean, you're checking the connections, you swap out the receiver, maybe you even run back to the store and buy a more expensive amplifier.
Yeah, but the problem isn't the equipment you bought at all. It's actually the electrical wiring hidden inside your walls. It is fundamentally flawed.
Right. It's slowly draining the power and corrupting the entire output of, like, literally anything you plug into it.
And until you actually rip out that bad wiring and replace it, I mean, no amount of expensive new gear is ever going to fix the sound. So, welcome to this deep dive.
Glad you're here with us.
Today, we are taking a custom stack of sources, specifically a fascinating text by Jack Spirko, and we're extracting a shortcut to rewiring the financial circuits inside your head. Our mission today is to pull out the most vital nuggets of insight from this material to help you, the listener, stop that hidden drain on your resources.
Yeah, and we are pulling all of today's analysis from a very specific source. It's Laws of Life, Book One, Ditch the System, Design Your Life by Jack Spirko.
Yep.
And we are focusing squarely on Chapter Two, which is titled Always Be Frugal, Never Be Cheap. Frugality breeds wealth, cheapness leads to poverty.
It's a bold title.
Yeah.
And to tackle a premise that massive, we're bringing our daily professional lives to the microphone today. In my day job as a practical personal finance coach, I sit down with families every single week. You know, we dig into their daily habits, we try to untangle their debt, and we really work on finding actual long-term value in their cash flow.
And in my work as a career and education decision analyst, my focus is usually a bit more on the macro level. I help students and young professionals objectively compare the raw costs of education, income projections, and really those massive life trade-offs that come with signing on the dotted line for a loan.
Which is huge.
Yeah, it really is. And look, we aren't here to sell you a budget app or some online course. We are here as educators to unpack, challenge, and clarify the core law of this chapter so you can apply it directly to your own life.
Right. And that core law is, well, it's the title itself. Always be frugal, never be cheap.
Always.
The chapter draws this massive, almost impenetrable line between those two concepts. Cheapness is described as a mindset rooted entirely in price and scarcity.
Right, whereas frugality focuses on value, long-term outcomes, and the intelligent, deliberate use of your money.
But to understand the financial outcomes you're getting in your life, you know, to find that bad wiring in the walls we talked about, we first have to look at the internal language that drives your decisions.
This was such a fascinating part of the chapter. The text introduces this concept that the words we use literally act as programming code for our minds.
Yeah.
Human beings think in words, right? It's like internal mental telepathy. And the author argues that the word cheap should be treated basically as a profane word.
It really is treated like a curse word throughout the whole chapter. And when you stop and think about the cultural associations, I mean, it makes total sense. Like, what comes to mind when you hear the word cheap?
Junk.
Exactly. It implies poor quality, means junk. It conjures up these images of, you know, miserly plastic crap that just breaks the second you use it.
Oh, for sure. It carries this aura of stinginess and even contempt.
Yeah. And the author makes a really compelling point here regarding behavioral economics. Using the word cheap in your internal monologue actually programs your brain to view money through a negative lens.
Right. It creates this software bug rooted in scarcity, like this background hum telling you that money is rare, that you can never afford the best, so you must always settle for the lowest price tag.
Operating with a cheap prompt in your mental computer literally programs you to take actions that paradoxically repel wealth.
Good, but I have to put on my finance coach hat here for a second and just introduce a little friction.
Go for it.
Is it really just a matter of semantics? I mean, if my client goes to the hardware store and thinks I need the cheapest tool, does that internal whisper genuinely alter their net worth over a
Well,
decade?
it's not magic, right? It's algorithmic. If your mental prompt is always, "What is cheapest today?" your brain acts like a computer running a really simple restrictive script.
Right, it just looks at the immediate numbers.
Exactly. It immediately shuts down any complex long-term analysis because you've only asked it to solve for the immediate present.
That makes
But
sense.
if you rewrite that prompt to a frugal mindset and instead ask, "What will this cost over time?" you've given your brain a much more sophisticated equation. You literally force it to calculate durability, replacement costs, and frankly, personal frustration.
So if cheap is a mental software bug, how does that bug actually manifest in the real world, like day to
It
day?
usually happens right there in the hardware store aisle when you're staring at two identical-looking products. The chapter uses this perfect, really mundane example of a garden hose.
Oh, the garden hose. We all know the sheer annoyance of a bad garden hose.
It's the worst.
The text breaks down the math of the cheap mindset perfectly. You go to a big box store, you buy a flimsy $15 hose. It looks totally fine on the shelf,
Sure.
but in practice, it kinks constantly, it gets super brittle when the temperature drops, and it just drives you crazy every time you water the lawn.
And inevitably, it splits or breaks after what, a season or two?
Exactly. So over a 5-year period, you end up replacing it 3 times. You've now bought 4 hoses, totaling $60.
Right. Now contrast that with the frugal choice. The author points to a high-quality 50-foot Gilmore hose priced at $29.
Now, to the cheap mindset, paying double the price for a hose is just unthinkable.
Unthinkable.
Yeah.
But that quality hose is engineered to last 5 to 10 years without kinking or bursting. So over that exact same 5-year span, your total out-of-pocket is just $29 compared to the cheap person's $60.
Wow. So the higher sticker price literally results in half the real cost over its useful life.
Half the cost. And beyond the math, you aren't spending 5 years wrestling with a piece of junk in the hot sun. I mean, that frustration is a massive hidden cost.
It really is. But the chapter immediately pivots to this exception that proves the rule, which is the Sanibel Island vacation
Oh,
example.
this one is great.
Yeah, so the author and his wife vacation there, and the hotel offers a beach chair and umbrella rental service for $20 a day. Over a 10-day trip, you're looking at $200 just to sit in the shade.
Which is wild. And you obviously can't pack full-size beach chairs in your checked luggage.
No, of course not. So rather than pay the crazy rental fee, they stopped at a Walmart after leaving the airport. They bought a cheap $20 umbrella and 2 $7 folding chairs. Total cost was $34. They used them for the 10 days, and then on their final day, they just walked down the beach and simply gave them away to another family.
Now, in my coaching practice, this is the exact nuance where people get tripped up. They think frugality means always buying the heavy-duty, expensive item. But this is where the intelligent allocation comes in. The cheap product was the frugal choice here.
Right, because the application only required temporary use. They matched the utility of the product to the timeline of the need.
Yes.
They didn't need chairs built to survive 10 years of heavy use. They just needed chairs to survive 10 days of sitting in the sand.
Exactly. And by understanding the true timeline, they saved, what, $166 and provided a nice bonus to another family.
Frugality isn't a rigid dogma, you know? It's a dynamic calculation of utility.
That makes perfect sense for $30 beach chairs. But moving from vacation logistics to massive lifestyle choices, that requires a much heavier lift. Like, how does this mindset scale to six-figure decisions?
That is where the mental programming gets incredibly powerful. The chapter introduces what I consider the foundational programming question of the entire text.
Okay, let's hear it.
Whenever you desire something, you must ask your brain to run this specific code. How can I have this thing, and what will I have to give up in order to do so?
The comparison the text uses to illustrate this is really striking. It's a $250,000 Lamborghini versus the author's used Ford F-350.
The math on the truck is fascinating. So the author bought a 2005 Ford F-350 for $16,500 in cash back in 2010.
Okay.
Over the first 9 years of owning it, he put roughly $3,500 into it for repairs and tires. Because of the heavy-duty nature of the vehicle, he expects to drive it for another decade.
Wow.
Yeah. When you amortize those numbers over its full lifespan, the true cost of operating that truck is around $1,100 a year.
Okay, but I have to play devil's advocate and challenge the underlying premise of this comparison, though.
Sure, what's your take?
Well, a truck and a supercar offer completely different experiences. If a client tells me their lifelong dream is to drive a Lamborghini, telling them to buy a used farm truck isn't going to solve their itch, you know?
Well, that's the friction point right there, and it's exactly why utility matching is so critical. The author's F-350 does the specific truck things his lifestyle requires, like towing a boat, accessing backcountry hunting spots, hauling heavy materials for homesteading. A Lamborghini literally can't do any of that.
Fair point.
But if the specific utility you are seeking is the visceral thrill of driving incredibly fast, the frugal choice isn't to buy a $250,000 depreciating asset. The frugal choice is to rent track time with a professional driving school for a day.
Ah, which satisfies the exact utility at a fraction of the cost. You get the thrill without the insurance, the maintenance, or that massive capital lockup.
Precisely. The author isn't saying he couldn't buy a Lamborghini. He's saying he doesn't value the utility of it enough to justify the massive amount of other opportunities he would have to sacrifice to acquire it. Frugal people are not depriving themselves. They are aligning their spending perfectly with their actual lifestyle. They look at the board and willingly accept the sacrifice of one thing to gain another more valuable thing.
Man, and to really grasp the weight of those sacrifices, we have to talk about the chapter's most profound paradigm shift. We basically have to redefine what money actually is. The text argues that money is stored energy.
It's essentially the thermodynamics of economics.
I love that phrase.
Think about your daily life. You go to work, you expend your physical and mental energy, you literally give up your time, and in return, you receive currency. That money acts as a battery. It stores the surplus of your human effort so you can deploy it later.
And the battery analogy in the text is incredibly vivid. Picture a standard little 9-volt battery. If you touch the terminals to your tongue, you get a tiny, harmless little zap.
Right, just a tingle.
But imagine taking 50 massive car batteries, wiring them all together in a series, and touching those leads.
The physical shock would be lethal. I mean, it would kill you.
Exactly. And the text argues that is exactly how money and debt function in our lives. Small amounts of money or a tiny amount of consumer debt might cause a little sting, but they do very little structural harm.
Yeah, you can recover from a 9-volt shock.
But massive amounts of money, and especially massive amounts of debt, possess lethal potential for your financial life. Money and debt demand deep, unwavering respect because they literally represent your life's energy.
And when you view debt through the lens of 50 car batteries, it exposes a massive societal blind spot.
How so?
Well, in the physical world, no one ignores the danger of a massive battery bank. But financially, we blindly encourage young people to wire themselves up to these massive financial batteries without a second thought, which leads us to the most dangerous application of this entire concept, student loans.
Oh, this is exactly your wheelhouse. The chapter draws a stark, almost infuriating comparison between a $60,000 business loan and a $60,000 college loan. Walk us through the mechanics of why these two identical sums of money are treated so differently.
Oh, absolutely. Okay, if you walk into a commercial bank tomorrow and ask a loan officer for $60,000 to start a landscaping company, they do not care how passionate you are about lawn care.
Not at all.
They demand a comprehensive business plan. They want to see your ROI projections, your market analysis, hard facts about your competitive advantage. They rigorously evaluate your actual ability to repay that specific sum.
Right. It's all about the math.
Exactly. And if the numbers don't prove you can generate a return, they deny the loan to protect both the bank and you from a catastrophic failure.
But when an 18-year-old wants to borrow that exact same $60,000 for a university degree,
they just sign a few pages of paperwork. There is no business plan required. There is no loan officer sitting across a desk interrogating the return on investment for, say, a sociology degree.
It's just a blank check, basically.
It is. And the chapter highlights the incredible danger of cultural marketing slogans, phrases we repeat constantly, like, everyone should go to college, or an education is priceless.
Yeah.
These are carefully crafted campaigns designed to bypass logic and elicit a purely emotional response.
In my coaching sessions, this is honestly the hardest spell to break. Parents come into my office practically in tears because they are drowning in parent PLEOS loans, all because they believe the slogan that any degree at any price is a golden ticket. Why is the cost so detached from reality?
The text explains the underlying mechanism really clearly. Government guarantees. Because the government guarantees these student loans, the financial risk is completely removed for the lenders and the universities.
Wow. Okay.
When institutions face zero risk of default, the natural market checks and balances just vanish. It leads to irrational market growth and wildly inflationary costs. Universities can raise tuition infinitely because the guaranteed loans will always cover the gap.
So you have massive inflationary costs on the front end, but what about the back end? Like the asset you are actually buying with all this debt.
You are buying a deflationary asset. Because the loans are so easy to get, there is a massive oversupply of generic college degrees in the market. And Economics 101, When the supply of something skyrockets, its value drops.
So you're paying more for something that's worth less.
Exactly. So as the author points out, you end up in a tragic scenario where an 18-year-old takes on $120,000 in high-interest debt to buy a communications degree that only qualifies them for a job paying $40,000 a year.
That's just devastating.
It's financial ruin before their career even starts.
So how do we fight back against this? If the system is designed to trap that stored energy, how do we evaluate these decisions logically?
The chapter's solution is brutal but effective. Run the math.
Just run the numbers.
Yes. Huh. Look at the specific field of study. Find the median starting income for that specific degree. Calculate the cost of living in the cities where those specific jobs actually exist. Calculate the monthly debt service for the loan required to get the degree.
And then what?
And then, the author says, just sit back and stare at those numbers for a few days before you sign anything.
Staring at the numbers strips away the emotion. And, you know, running the map isn't just a strategy for dodging the college trap. It's a vital life skill for any major expenditure. This brings us to a foundational rule in the text regarding spreadsheets.
Yes, the spreadsheets.
The chapter quotes Darby Simpson, who famously says, "Excel never lies."
It really is the ultimate truth teller. I mean, as long as you input honest data into a spreadsheet, it will spit out the unvarnished reality of your situation.
Right. And to enforce this, the chapter proposes a hard and fast rule. Any expenditure larger than 1 week of your income must be put into an Excel spreadsheet for evaluation before you make the purchase.
No exceptions. And to make that spreadsheet evaluation actually work, the author provides a specific framework. It's called the TRUE method, T-R-U-E. It stands for total return on every expenditure.
This is basically the practical toolkit for synthesizing everything we've talked about today. Let's really break down the nuts and bolts of this method.
Okay, let's start with the T, which stands for time horizon. You have to ask, how long will this item actually serve me?
Right.
The difference between cheap and frugal often comes down to the calendar. Cheap thinking operates in days or weeks. Frugal thinking operates in years or decades. The longer the realistic, useful life of an item, the more honest your price comparison becomes, just like that 50-foot garden hose.
Then we move to the R, which is real cost. This requires you to completely ignore the sticker price staring at you on the shelf. You have to calculate the total life cycle cost.
Right, which is way more than just the price tag.
Exactly. That includes the price of inevitable replacements, mm-hmm. the cost of maintenance, the energy required to repair it, and the sheer frustration of dealing with a subpar tool. A cheap purchase might look fantastic at the cash register, but it quietly bleeds your wallet dry through repetition over its time horizon.
Next is U for utility. Does the quality of the item match the actual job it needs to perform? If you rely on something every single day to earn a living, like a carpenter's drill or a chef's knife, it requires a much higher quality standard than a tool you use once a year. Frugal people match the quality standard to the actual utility.
That's the Sanibel Island beach chair example applied mathematically. You don't buy a 10-year chair for a 10-day utility.
Exactly. And finally, the E stands for exchange. This is the step most consumers actively suppress.
Oh, for sure.
What must I give up to have this? Since we know money is stored energy, spending it means you are irrevocably exchanging your past effort for this new item.
You have to ask. Could I invest this stored energy somewhere else that yields a higher return?
Yes. When you force yourself to articulate the specific opportunity cost, the shiny appeal of the purchase often just evaporates.
It is a complete paradigm shift in how we interact with the material world. As we synthesize everything we've covered today, it really comes down to a few core shifts in perspective.
Yeah, let's review those.
The cheap person is obsessed with what something costs today. But the frugal person is focused on what it costs over the long haul.
And realizing that quality usually lowers the true cost for items we use frequently, it's about shifting the focus from price to value.
Exactly. And understanding that frugality is never about deprivation. It is the intelligent allocation of resources.
Right. The goal isn't to spend the least amount of money possible. The goal is to get the absolute best long-term outcome for the stored energy you've decided to spend.
Because money represents your own time and effort. Respecting your money means respecting the physical and mental energy it took to earn it. And ultimately, it's the consistent, small, daily decisions that shape your long-term wealth far more than occasional massive windfalls.
To cement these shifts, the chapter concludes by providing literal new lines of code for the reader to install in their mental computer.
These are the mental code rewrites we discussed earlier.
Yep. We are going to recite these exactly as they are written in the text, so you can begin running these scripts the next time you make a financial decision.
Here is the first rewrite. Computer, when I want something, run the code. How can I have it, and what must I give up?
Computer, when I consider a purchase, evaluate value, not price.
And the final rewrite. Computers, before spending money, calculate the real cost over time.
If you want to explore more of these frameworks and dig deeper into how to apply these laws to design your own life, you can find a wealth of resources at jackslaws.com.
We've covered massive ground today, navigating the psychology of cheapness, the utility of beach chairs, the macroeconomic trap of student loans, and the thermodynamic reality of stored energy. But before you go, we want to leave you with one final provocative thought to mull over.
Think back to our opening analogy, that faulty hidden wiring behind the walls causing the persistent static in the stereo system.
Look around your house today, or, you know, pull up your latest credit card statement and ask yourself a hard question. What is one cheap item or one cheap recurring habit that is secretly draining your battery of stored energy right now? Find that bad wiring. Rip it out.
Thank you for joining us for this deep dive. Be sure to check out jackslaws.com for more insights.
Until next time, respect your energy, calculate your true costs, and remember, always be frugal, never be cheap.